Buckle up, folks, because Tricia Kennedy, Director of Dispute Resolutions at the American Airlines Pilots Association, is in the hot seat on the Pressure Tested podcast today. We're about to take flight with discussions on negotiation, the pilot shortage, and even the world of blue-collar entrepreneurship.
So, as you know, we have a construction company and we have an HVAC company here, and we consistently see problems with labor shortages. People do not want to get into skilled trades. We really see it on the HVAC side. Basically, the average age for a technician is 45 to 55,
wow.
And they're all retiring.
Yeah.
And there's this huge knowledge gap that's about to happen. And so I was really interested to hear what you had to say on the phone about the aviation industry, that you guys are seeing kind of similar things to what we see on our side with pilot demand.
Very true. There's a huge pilot shortage going on right now. It's been going on for about 3 or 4 years now, maybe even longer. And unfortunately, as the industry, you know, can be very brutal. It can be very brutal on its employees, on its pilot group particularly. And over time, what I've seen shrink is the fact that most airline pilots, they're part of a family, right? So the grandfather, the grandmother, the daughter, the granddaughter will all be pilots. It's a long line, right? But because the industry has taken such difficult turns, particularly with the popular Chapter 11 bankruptcies, and because of the fact that a lot of pensions have been lost, a lot of hourly wages have gone down dramatically, particularly after 9/11, families started to say to the people they love the most, hey, don't be a commercial pilot. Go do something else. Go do maybe anything else. Because you don't control, there's so many things that go into the airline industry. Every challenge is there. They steered their younger generation away from it. And of course now, many of those pilots, they have to retire at the age of 65, commercial pilots.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they have to retire. And so then you have the gap. On top of that, another problem with maintaining a supply of pilots, in my opinion, is it's a difficult job. The lifestyle of the job is challenging. You are gone a lot. You travel the world a lot, which sounds exciting, but when you actually go and live out of that suitcase, it's a different experience. So it's not a lifestyle that appeals to a lot of people. So that kind of shrinks your pool of candidates. And then on top of that, it's just the, and as you know, to do these sorts of work, it has to be
right person.
Hold on, let me restart that. It's not for everyone, essentially.
Right.
Okay, so you have to have the background, you have to have the knowledge, you have to have that mechanical bent to do the work. So with that, your number of candidates shrinks because you really have to be good under pressure as well. And there's only so many people who can comprehend and understand how that aircraft works, right? You have to understand all the various systems on that aircraft, and you have to be able to master it. And then in the event of an emergency, if something goes wrong, then you have to rely on your training and your background to fix that problem right then. So the number of candidates naturally is small. And then with the brutal impact of the industry and people turning and encouraging their family members to go a different direction, it's a shortage on our hands.
That's insane. So one of the things you said in our pre-podcast phone call, and you just kind of said it just then, and that I definitely did not know. So every time I've ever walked past a pilot, I definitely he's got the uniform on and he looks super professional, and I know he's got a super hard job, but I really underestimated how difficult their jobs are. You know, I likened my pilot to an Uber driver. Like, his job is just to get me from point A to point B, and that's it. Like, I had no clue that they had anything to do with the mechanical side of the airplane at all, or that, so you told me that they do like a walk around the airplane.
Sure. There's a pre-flight checklist that they have to do. And the pilot, just like the mechanic, just like everybody else, they are a huge piece of the safety puzzle.
Okay.
So they're really your last check.
Right.
Before that thing starts to try to defy gravity, right?
So do they really, like, let's say that, you know, the pilot discovers a maintenance issue and he has maintenance come out, they fix it, but it's still not to his approval. Like, he still doesn't feel comfortable. Does he get the final word on if he feels comfortable flying that day?
They can always reject the aircraft.
Wow.
And they better have a good reason.
Oh, well, yeah. Do that, you don't just do it for fun.
Or anything like that. And, you know, most major commercial airlines maintain their aircraft in a way that rarely happens. But if they're uncomfortable, they can reject that aircraft.
Wow. That's really interesting. I would have never known that was the case. I think so much more of pilots now. I don't know why I didn't know that obviously, who else is going to take care of the airplane at 30,000 feet other than the pilot? Like, it was really naive of me not to, you know, to think that. The other thing I wanted to touch on that you just said, that there's always a lot of news and, maybe I'm the only one in the dark about this, but tell me a little bit about all these pensions that were lost. I don't even know about this.
Sure, sure. So it's funny that you liken them to an Uber driver, because although Uber drivers have a tough job and I respect them, I think that, you know, when you think about the training and the pilots have to go back to school, you know, every so often, and they have a on-the-spot training that they must complete, and you know, they're tested on a regular basis. This can be every 6 months, 9 months, sometimes a year, and so they are tested every time, so that way they can live up to that emergency, right? So when you think about that, and what an important piece of the safety puzzle they are, part of their compensation is that they had traditional pension plans. Most of them did.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, as they went through the bankruptcy crunch, as these big companies went through the bankruptcy crunch, you can take away that pension. You can freeze the pension. And so their pensions are frozen, and that's obviously a huge cost savings for the management side.
Sure.
They're often replaced with a 401k program.
Okay.
So it's not like they don't have a retirement
vehicle. That's not much of a replacement.
But it's painful.
Yeah,
it's tough.
Absolutely.
It's very tough. And so that's why, you know, when the older generations were looking at the people they love the most and saying, should I become a pilot?
Right.
You know, they think and pause about, you know, what happened to them throughout those crises, you know?
Absolutely.
And the losses they sustained.
So we were researching this, and so the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts the average salary of a pilot, and lots of things being said in that sentence, average salary pilot, not saying what kind of pilot, but they put it at $120,000.
Yeah.
But when I originally talked to you, your estimate was much higher. So I want to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about and there's a lot of numbers out there that you
absolutely
can look at.
Of course.
But when you generally look at the research for the big three commercial airlines, Delta, United, American. That number's much greater,
right?
Around 300.
Wow.
So, and of course, they're the premier airlines. They're flying the world, that sort of thing. So everything's a little bit different, but it's certainly an excellent career path for young people to pursue. you don't necessarily have to have a 4-year degree, although that's great to have.
Sure.
You can go to flight school. You can learn it through the military. There's a lot of avenues for people to enter into this field. So I encourage everyone to do it, and especially women.
$300,000 is a lot of money to anybody.
Right.
I think that's amazing. So I know that you mentioned that your company, and obviously the different airlines, what do you all do to try to re-engage people in this idea of becoming pilots? Like, what, you know, do you get into the schools, or what do you do in the community?
Right. APA, what they do, of course, we encourage our pilots to get to go to those career days, right? And and just talk to people about it, you know. Another thing we do is there's all kinds of aviation shows mm-hmm. that happen all year, well, in the summer and fall months. Mm-hmm. They're in most large towns, and it's an air show.
Yeah.
And APA will always have support a booth or something mm-hmm. like that with educational materials. So that way, you know, you get people who are naturally interested and they're bringing their family to the air show. Mm-hmm. Two, they're actual pilots there they can talk to, and yeah. we encourage the pilots to engage in that. And three, of course, they get right up there. They get to see the mm-hmm. the aircraft, the operation, yeah. and get into the aircraft.
Right.
Particularly when you can at the air shows, you can tour various aircraft and that sort of thing and talk to the people involved. So we encourage them to do that.
Well, I think that's a great play. And I think that's a lot easier play than, you know, some of the skilled trade stuff that we deal with. Because, and we talked about this on the phone, but every time I think about a pilot, I don't know why, but I always bring up in my brain, Catch Me If You Can. And I just think that really just romanticized the pilots of, I guess it was probably the 70s. Mm-hmm. But I still, whenever I see a pilot walk by in the airport, there's like the uniform, it just kind of sets them apart from regular people. So I do think that there's a lot of respect by them going to the career fair. I mean, mm-hmm. kids look up to them and want to be them. So it's so strange that, you know, when something is, you know, they pay $300,000, mm-hmm. you get to wear the cool uniform, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, you would think that there would be more kids wanting to get into this. It's crazy to me that there's not. It's tough.
I agree. And I also think, too, though, that think about it, since 9/11, every yeah. major air carrier has gone, just about everybody's done the Chapter 11 wash, you
wow.
know, Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Right.
And not only do your pensions go away, then there's a merger sometimes, mm. okay? And what can be challenging in a merger is that, you know, you have a seniority number, and you fall into the line, right? So
right.
that can impact, you know, your ability to move up.
Yep.
So although it is romanticized,
mm-hmm.
it's just that, you know, when you really take a careful look at it
mm-hmm.
To make sure, can you sustain that through
right.
your life? Like right now is a great season
yeah.
For pilots, mm-hmm. right? Finally, thank
yeah.
you. Finally, a great season, because 300 hasn't always been the number,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's true.
So it's a great season right now, but after 9/11, it's tough. It really is. And then on top of that, too, just even if you want to become a pilot, if you don't have that discipline,
mm-hmm.
they're very intelligent people, very disciplined people,
yep.
very linear thinking, excellent under pressure, can consume a lot of information, keep it current for a long mm-hmm. period of time, and by the way, work well with others. That's a tough person to find.
Yeah, that is a tough person to find. So they have to go through certain like mental tests too, to like check their like emotional stability and all of that.
Well, you know, you do have to maintain a first class medical or a medical certificate.
Okay.
And there's all kinds of standards with that. Everything from your eyes to your ears to your heart to your mind, you know, everything has to fall within a parameter. And every so often you have to go to a doctor and the doctor's going to evaluate you
yeah.
and make sure that you still fall within those parameters.
Yeah.
So it can be very challenging.
I bet. I mean, yeah, because you got to think that the doctor's got to make sure that emergency doesn't happen, you know, the heart attack or whatever.
I mean,
yeah, it's crazy. It's got to be stringent. Okay. So I want to switch topics,
sure.
and I want to talk about what you do.
Okay.
So you are the Director of Disputes Resolution at Allied Pilots Association.
Correct.
And so your job is to negotiate. That's what you do. And it just, I think that there's so much that we can talk about with negotiation. But let's just say that you have negotiated a deal and a couple years goes by and you realize that this deal is not what's right for your group now. What does your just pre-planning process look like before you ever get back to the table for the negotiation?
Sure. And so keep in mind with collective bargaining, your agreement or mm-hmm. your deal has so many years associated
right.
with it, right?
Yeah.
And so then there's going to be some planning that goes on as that contract's about to expire. And our team that does that work have tremendous amount of planning and in organization what they do. What I do on the litigation side is I look at it and say, okay, I have a case. And how do I plan my negotiation to solve that case, to address that issue, right?
Okay.
And the most important thing is, as they always say, it's 90% preparation,
mm-hmm.
and that's research.
Right.
You have to know what you've got,
mm-hmm.
where you want to go, and how you can get there, right?
Okay.
So you have to know everything about, let's say, in your circumstance, if you're looking to, I don't know, purchase a new company, mm-hmm. you have to look and see and find out everything you can about that company, mm-hmm. all the research about it, all the numbers you can on that, everything about that income and balance sheet, everything. And then really understand the industry mm-hmm. that you're looking yep. at assuming. So that way, when you make your move, you can really understand how it fits in and how it doesn't fit in. On top of that, I think so the numbers are extremely important, and then the customer need is so important, right? The customer base. How is this, what's your business plan, and how is this going to fit into the marketplace in a way that serves a need and, of course, is profitable, right?
Right.
That's what you need. And also, too, I think what you need is really a good understanding of once you acquire it, how you manage it, how mm-hmm. you staff it, how you look at it, how mm-hmm. you're going to sell this thing.
Yep.
And, you know, with those basics, and that's going to take the majority of your right. effort. So in my case, if I'm looking at, let's say, a grievance, I make sure I really, really understand the facts.
Yeah.
Everything about the facts. What happened that mm-hmm. day or in those events. Mm-hmm. Then I understand, what does our contract say about
yep.
this? And how solid are we on that? Is the language clear? Are we sure?
Yeah.
Is there some ambiguity there? And
right.
if there's some ambiguity, which way could it go? And think through all those different ways to interpret that contract language. And then you have to think about, okay, what do I really want here? Do I want money damages? Do I want a change in process? If that's what I want, then I have to label that very specifically. And then, of course, you have to get client approval on it. And then you move forward with trying to negotiate with it. And then you start to play with the pieces in a way that you get it between the goalposts, if
right,
you will.
Right, right. That's what I was just going to... No, totally. That's what I was just going to ask. So you do all of your preparation. You know, and you know something you said on the pre-podcast phone call, and I just thought, wow, yeah. she's a total badass. But you basically said, when I get to that table, no one is more prepared than me.
Right.
You know the deal in and out. And you basically said that you feel confident having these deals because you know that you've done your homework on it. I thought that was really cool.
Because I am kind of a naturally shy person, believe
really?
It or not. So when I'm walking in the room and there's a lot of people in
yep,
the room
yep.
and you're going to be talking, a lot of people are going to be looking at you,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And you got to get that courage, you know?
Nice.
So you have your basic courage, right?
Yep.
But then you think, you know what? Nobody else has spent more time on this than me.
That's
Nobody
good.
Else has looked at this like me. I have worked hard on this. I understand it.
Yep.
Whatever you bring, I know what you're going to bring.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you a breath of confidence and I think a bit of presence that if I'm not as prepared,
yep.
I don't deliver the same way.
That makes a ton of sense. So you go into the negotiation knowing kind of an ABC fallout. So let's say that A is what you want,
mm-hmm.
but you know that C is what you can take if you have to.
Right.
How do you once you've said your A, you've put mm-hmm. A out there, how do you kind of get, you know, all negotiations aren't gonna get
right.
the outcome you want. How do you position yourself to still get most of what you want?
Right. And, you know, I really think the smartest thing to do is look at it from your opposition side.
Okay.
Really understand what they have at risk, what they want out mm-hmm. of this, what they can't give, understand where their lines are, and then develop a way to explain your deal terms in a way that are mutually beneficial for everyone.
Hmm.
And the reason why you should agree to this is because your needs are satisfied here because of this, and this. It takes care of us because of this, and this.
So you're saying that you structure exactly what you want to be both what you want and what's good for them as well.
Well, I try to look at what I want
mm-hmm.
and then try to explain how that benefits them. And also, too, if and if, you know, depending on the situation and going against the same opponent often,
yep.
many times there's some consistent criteria that they need.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can blend that in, that makes it more credible, easier for them. Make it as easy as you can on them to say yes and get there.
Is so good because that was exactly what I wanted to say next. And I think that, you know, you're going to have different types of negotiations in your life. And I think that, you know, you mentioned that you negotiate with the same people. You know, every 3 years you're sitting down with the same group of people. How does your strategy change when you're negotiating with somebody once versus, you know, you're going to be negotiating at the table with them every 3 years?
Yeah.
How does your strategy change?
Right. And I work more in the grievance world. So every case I have, it's with American, right?
Yeah.
So what I do with them is, you know, I think this. I have to think long term.
Right.
I do. I can't do one and done and burn and run, you know, because you're going to lose credibility. They're not going to want to work with you and you're not going to get anything done. So I try to position myself as, you know, very credible, extremely knowledgeable. And of course, you have to, you know, your ethics have to be 110%. You can't promise things that you can't deliver, you know, that sort of thing. So you really have to, again, going back to the research, going back to the preparation table, you got to know what your client wants and you got to figure out a way to deliver it. And you better not represent otherwise to particularly your client or certainly your opponent, because then everyone loses.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. You know, you don't really have to think about, I mean, of course, you always have to think about your credibility. You always have to think about your ethics anytime you negotiate with anybody. But especially if you promise something and then you don't deliver on it, the next time you go to the table, you're going to have a really difficult time getting them to believe you. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So a couple of things that we talked about with, actually, before I go into that, you said something to me on the phone.
Yeah.
I loved it so much. I wrote it on my board because I thought it was so relevant to just my day-to-day activity. You said, it's okay to disagree, but it's not okay to be disagreeable.
Right.
Just keep saying that to me. I love that. I think that that's so smart.
No, and that's another factor when you're dealing with the same opponent over and over and over, right? Because we have huge disagreements about core issues, right?
Right.
But, you know, you have to put your case forward in a way that doesn't immediately turn everyone off, because who keeps listening to the person who's, you know, pounding the table, aggressive, over the top? No one wants to deal with that. No one does, ever. So if you can say, look, I understand this is a topic which we disagree, and I want to communicate about our position, and I want to communicate how I understand your position, so I can start to understand your position better. Give them a little bit of power. And then start to talk about how you understand their position to be. And then it's going to start to turn into a conversation as opposed to a you versus me negotiation over everything, right?
I'm pretty much not allowed to talk about politics, but if we could talk about politics,
I
mean, that would pretty much solve all of the political issues in the world. I mean, imagine, you know, your opposing sides, your... Imagine them just sitting down and saying, hey, I see where you're coming from, but here's what I think. And really just being agreeable instead of just consistently just disagreeing. What could that do for the world? We could just figure that out.
I know. They only could.
That's interesting. Okay, I've got another statistic for you. So 46% of men will take a risk and negotiate in comparison to 34% of women.
Yeah.
Why are women less inclined to negotiate?
I think part of it is how we were raised.
Really?
Be
what do you
agreeable.
Mean by that? You know, oh, be
I
agreeable.
Mean, be agreeable.
Interesting.
Be the, you know, be the family glue.
Yeah.
Take care of everyone else.
Dang.
You know, that sort of
thing. I missed all those days growing up, apparently.
Well, my generation, at least, that kind of got that.
Yeah.
It's
interesting.
And I also think, too, that, you know, women are more, they tend to be more relationship-based as opposed to productivity-based.
Okay.
You know, that seemed to be a focus that's put upon women. I'm not saying it's right, but it's there.
Sure.
Okay?
Yeah, definitely.
I also think, too, that, what is a risk, by the way?
Yeah.
You know, what is a risk?
Yeah. We talk about this a lot.
And they look at that and say, you know, well, this is a risk, that is a risk. Well, who's defined those?
Yeah.
And are you really asking the women whether or not they took a risk?
Yeah.
And how they evaluate risk?
Let's play it with salary, right?
Yeah.
I mean, let's just say that if I sit down, I can look back and think about the people that I've hired, and the men that I hired always tried to negotiate their salary, and a lot of the women didn't. They were just, it's almost like they were just appreciative that I offered them something. Yeah. It's like just such a different, I don't understand the dynamic. I really don't. I mean, but even like, I don't, you know, I've, and obviously like I'm really blessed to have found the position that I'm in and all of that, but I've never negotiated my salary ever. And it's almost like I never felt comfortable doing it. It's almost like a sense of worth, a little bit.
Unfortunately,
like women don't have the same sense of worth that men do. Like what men feel their value and know their value, and I think that women really struggle with that, which is unfortunate.
I think we're just coming into it, unfortunately, and I think part of it is how the world views it, right? I also think too that. You know, mentoring is so important. Men have been better at the mentoring side
Absolutely.
Than women have been. So, you know, whenever I have the opportunity, I'm telling, you know, my nieces, you know, hey, you've got a job now. Now let's see that. Mm-hmm. Let's look at that deal.
Yep.
Let's see, you know, what's a reasonable counter for you to make.
Ah,
and just, you know, very nicely, you know, lay that out. And
totally agree.
And but I just don't know that women have had that kind of mentoring or that thought process, or they know what they want going into it. And if it hits it, then okay, that's all right,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
So I think as generations go by mm-hmm. and people think about it, and also women, I think, need to do a better job of helping each other in the same generation, you know?
Absolutely.
Supporting each other.
Yep.
There is something to the networks, right?
Oh,
And
definitely.
Men have mastered that, and women, I think, are still catching up to that.
That is why I wanted to start the podcast. Because as I was coming up through my career, still, you know, still as I come through my career, I've only had male mentors.
Yeah.
And that's really disappointing for me because there's so many things that I go through as a mom, as a woman in, you know, typically in a room with all men that I would love to have a female mentor to be like, hey, so this happened. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to start the podcast because I feel like podcasts are kind of that interesting in between. It's in between a conversation. You know, you can sit in your car and you can listen to it, but you can still learn from it. And you can still learn from it in a kind of an intimate way because you're listening to somebody have the conversation. And I thought, you know, I obviously can't provide mentorship to 100,000 people, how can I bring some value to them? How can I get really smart women to tell how they did it or what they would do, or if they were sitting down to negotiate their next salary, this is what they would demand.
Right.
You know, I wanted to bring those stories to people. So
I
hope that's what we do with this podcast. I mean, I think that's
because especially, on the salary piece, think about it. There's so much information out there on salary bands.
Mm-hmm.
You can use that information and whatever they give you, you know, you can always just say, hey, I need 10%. I want to suggest 10% more.
Yeah.
And you got to have a why with it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good.
And if they say no, just say, well, I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Yeah. Why are people so afraid to get no? I mean, the idea of like fear of rejection terrifies me. Like if I walk into a situation knowing that I'm probably going to hear a no, I mean, I've gotten over this later in life because I hear no a lot, but I would have been nervous to ask if I thought a no was possible when I was younger. Now, I get met with no all the time. I just keep asking.
Exactly.
It's tough.
It is. It really is. But you know what? If you think about it, and the first time you do it, it's really, really hard.
Yep.
And you know, like when I negotiated my first college, out of college, my first salary I negotiated, they offered me, and I'll never forget, they offered me $20,000.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Uh-huh. So it was a long time ago. And that actually wasn't too bad. And I said, so I talked to my dad about it, right? And my dad was the person who says, you have to counter.
Yeah. Okay.
You That's have good. To. I was like, what? What? Counter what? And so, you know, I went in there and I said, well, I appreciate the offer. I really need $25,000. And I think because of my grade point average and this internship I did, I'd like additional consideration on that. And you know what? They came up $2,200. Mm. So, you know,
you
and
go.
It taught me, hey, that was good.
Yeah.
That was good. Because when you
that
think about it.
Yeah. That, I mean, you get reinforced.
Yeah. They're negotiating too. Mm-hmm. So they're starting, they figure you're going to negotiate with them. So they hold a little back so they can meet that meet that.
Yeah, that's true. We talk about that. That, you know, well, you don't have to start at the highest number that you're willing to give. You can negotiate.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're not that great at that here.
And of course, you know, another thing for women, another reason why is when you look at their, what kind of 401k they're offering you, right?
Yeah.
And if there isn't a 401k, then you have to say, well, I'll need some additional funds in my salary to commit to that.
Yeah,
you know,
that makes sense.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
Whole package.
Hey, one of the things I noticed about your background that I thought was really interesting, especially in this world where people jump from job to job like every 3 years. They're looking for a new role. They're bored with their role. You've been at APA since 2002.
I know.
What continues to motivate you to do that job?
You know, I think, honestly, we've got great leadership. Mm. We do. We have great leadership within our staff, and we have great leadership within our union, our pilots who run our union. And there's always a new challenge. There's always a new opportunity. I feel appreciated and rewarded. I feel fairly compensated. Mm. I feel called out when I don't hit the mark in a responsible, productive way as an opportunity to improve. We all have those. And I always feel like, you know, wow, they value me. And I see good results. So I'm also too... I see value in staying and growing and learning, mm-hmm. where today everybody hops, mm-hmm. and I appreciate people who can do that because I'm not a hopper. Even back in the day, I wasn't a hopper, you know. I see that, you know, when you go through that experience, mm-hmm. and you get some patina on you, it starts to, others start to value that,
yep.
and you get a reputation. And you can grow and foster from there. I think it's a good thing. I have felt valued and challenged, and that's why I keep coming back.
Yeah, I think that that's amazing. I mean, you pretty much hit the nail on the head for what every company wants to give their employees, but most, you know, miss. You said something that I thought was really interesting. You said, I feel compensated fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's so interesting, that idea, because I think that a lot of people, and, you know, I know you're not supposed to say how much somebody makes and you're not supposed to tell somebody what you make, but I think so much of how people look at how they're compensated is it fair versus somebody else that does something similar to what I do?
Right.
And as soon as you stop feeling like your compensation is fair, it creates all of this, like, animosity.
It's a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
It's
it
a
is
huge
a
distraction. Because then all of that energy that they sort of... You're dedicating to that. Mm-hmm. You don't dedicate to the work product.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I felt like something was a kilter,
yep.
I walked into my boss's office and said, I have an issue.
Yeah.
And it deals with compensation.
Yeah.
And I feel you're paying him more.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing the same job.
Exactly. Yep.
And I need a raise.
Mm-hmm.
So how are we going to address this now? Do you need me to write out what I've accomplished?
Yeah.
Do you need me to? And, you know, it was acknowledged and it was fixed.
Yeah. And that's because that's all you want.
And that was years and years ago.
Yep.
But, you know, and I don't know how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Companies are a lot better now at comparing and looking and measuring.
Absolutely.
Where, you know, 20 years ago, they weren't.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, the startup, it has a really hard time with that, too. Because it's just... You know, you're kind of trying to grab all this talent, and you're like, okay, well, I want that person. You're just grabbing them all in, and then at the end, you're like, oh, well, we ended up paying that person a lot more than we paid this person. And it does. It creates, because as soon as somebody feels like they're not being fairly compensated, their motivation just diminishes. They're like, well, they don't really value me anyway. What am I even doing here? I mean, it's interesting. I actually read this book one time called Drive, and he talks about, it's a lot of different stuff about motivation, but he talks about the scenario where basically there's these two people, and I'm going to butcher this, I'm sure, but it's so interesting, where basically the guy has $10 and he can give $5, or I can give $5 to you and I'll keep $5, or I can take $9, I'll give you $1. And the other person oftentimes would walk away from getting that dollar because they thought the entire situation was unfair.
Right.
Instead of taking the dollar, which would make them $1 richer than they are today, they would just walk because they didn't think the situation was fair. And I think that that really plays into how we're motivated. Like, if you don't think your situation is fair, that's it. You're going to walk, for sure.
And it's one of those things where my father taught me was, be careful who you do business with, you know, because they're going to treat you just how you think they're going to treat you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's why you walk away from just the dollar, because you don't want to engage in business with that person.
Yeah.
No, thank you. You're
that's
not going to be part of my life, and your money's not going to be part of my life.
Yeah, that you're totally right. That is it. Okay. I want to hear about your dad. Tell me what your dad did.
My dad was an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
He owned a business. He started out really working in a blue collar job on the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he and my mom met. They got married. They started to have children.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, as he had five children, we're expensive.
Yeah.
So, and my dad always had an artistic and entrepreneurial bend. So he always had multiple jobs. And he happened while he was at the railroad to also get a second job working at a dental supply company. Mm-hmm. And he did everything for them, whatever they needed him to do. And he started to learn the art of making dental products, bridges, crowns, a full set of dentures for people. And back then, it was a very limited population who kind of had this kind of industry,
right,
who did this kind of job. And because my dad was a painter, he really enjoyed seeing the people really form the teeth and from the certain materials.
Yeah.
First of all, working with the materials, crafting the materials, getting them into a state where then you could finish them to look like a beautiful crown or a bridge for your teeth. And he watched them do it. He learned how to do it, and he was good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him some materials, some extra materials that they were going to discard to take home and practice, and he used those. And then along the way, as they were discarding materials, he would ask, hey, can I take those?
Mm-hmm.
Can I like to work with this at home because I like to try. And they're like, sure. He was up for it with what he was doing, and they were honest and generous and said, sure, we don't need that. Go ahead, take it, use it. As time went on, he started to collect quite a bit from them. They would replace their machines that they would use, their fine drills.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be like, well, here's one for you, Dave.
Oh,
you know,
great.
This one, we don't need this one anymore. Yeah. So we'd take that, he'd take that. And after a while, he really got good at it.
Mm-hmm.
He enjoyed doing it. He started to make a small network for himself, and he told them, I want to start my own shop.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, go ahead and do it. They had a certain specialty they'd send him work to do.
Okay.
And he had his own network for it. Meanwhile, on the railroad, he told them, look, I need to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I want to start and commit this entire time to developing my own business.
Mm-hmm.
And the railroad, of course, respected that, but they held his position open as long as they could, so he could come back at the same seniority, same pay, in case that business failed, because as you know, a lot of new businesses fail.
Sure.
And then because he was able to kind of put together these things that the other folks didn't need and they discarded, he built his business on that.
Wow.
Very successful.
That's great.
The go-to guy in his area for that, and he was extremely successful.
Wow.
And that thing put me through college and law school. So I'm like, I'm so glad you did that, Dad.
So when you were talking about it, you said they, but you were actually referring to the union that held his job, right?
Yes, the union had a contract,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things they negotiated was you could leave, but you had the opportunity to come back for a certain amount of time. They could extend it.
Yeah.
And thank God they negotiated that. Because, you know, although he wanted to make more money, it was a good job.
Yeah.
He could support his family on that.
Well, yeah.
But he wanted to take the risk. And my mother always complimented the union for providing that, for checking with my dad, seeing how he was, following up with him, making sure he was okay, and trying, really being part of his life, even though he was gone, and saying, we're still holding this open. Another thing, too, is they could hold it open so long as no one else bid for the job.
Right.
And so the word got out. My dad was leaving.
Mm-hmm.
He was starting this new career.
Yeah.
It was kind of crazy because everybody knew he had five kids,
right,
and they all thought he was crazy to do it, right? Because it is kind of crazy.
Sure.
And you know what? Nobody bid on that job.
Yep.
A lot of people could have used that job. It was more money.
Mm-hmm.
It was a better shift. My dad said, you know, my coworkers supported me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his point
says
was
always, a lot about his person.
Yeah. Never forget those folks.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure. That's insane. That's incredible. What a cool story. Do you think that has Was that one of the reasons you decided to work for a union?
Yeah, you know, and a lot of people think, oh, you know, the word union brings up, you know, big eyes and
yeah,
kind of,
Texas.
Oh, no. And I say, no. I grew up in the Midwest where mm-hmm. unions are very popular. And in fact, you know, it was a very positive experience. You know, I remember going to the union hall. They had my friend's dad was active there. We were little kids. They had the best playground.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Miss Sue out there helping us.
Yeah.
She'd give us some juice.
Aww.
We could play out there. I mean, they looked at the family, mm-hmm. right? And I had a very positive feeling of unions growing up. I saw what they did. I saw the value they brought.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that they were sort of a weight to make it fair. You know,
yeah.
They balanced things. They kept things in line. They held people accountable.
Mm.
So to me, I thought that was a good thing.
That's perfect.
It's interesting.
That's awesome. What a cool
yeah.
story. Trisha, thank you so much for coming
yes.
on the podcast today. I had such a good time. Oh, yeah. It was so good talking to you and hearing all about the aviation industry. I hope
thank
you come
you.
Back.